Well, welcome to another episode of Fruken Conversation. I'm really excited again today. I have Tasha Osman. She's a part-time professor at the University of Ottawa and a full-time science and mathematics teacher with the Western Quebec School Board. Her research employs decolonizing, psychoanalytical, and post-colonial frameworks in the areas of curriculum studies, mathematics, and more recently, queer studies. Her work appears in journals like the Journal of the Canadian Association of Curriculum Studies, Multicultural Education Review, and Transnational Curriculum Inquiry. She's also co-authored a number of book chapters in books like Disney Culture and Curriculum and the Critical Youth Studies Reader. She's presently working on research approaches to decolonizing teaching in secondary science and mathematics classrooms and is currently exploring the intersection between visual arts-based pedagogies and biology. Tasha, so excited to have you here. I know we've been talking about this. I really looking so forward to our conversation today and learning more about what you're doing with your students in the classroom and how the research that you've done has informed that work. But before we get into that, I just was wondering, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing so great. And I'm really glad that we're having this conversation today. And I'm just living in the liminal space between digital moments and being face-to-face part-time in the classroom. It's been really amazing navigating this new terrain and to be able to have this conversation this morning.
Well, it's hard to believe because, look, I live in Ottawa, the capital city of Canada, but you're just on the other side. You're in Quebec, so there's just a bridge over the other side. But the government policies and the kind of context that have been taking place in these two provinces, even though we're in the Ottawa region and we're just side by side neighbors, like 10, 15 minutes away from each other. What was it like when we're almost a year into the pandemic? What was it like? Where were you at when we all had to transition or quote unquote pivot? I know everyone's getting tired of that term. Last year at this time,
I actually remember the day distinctly, and I remember it because I work with the school band at Hadley Filmon Wright High School, which is just across the river, as you say, from the Ottawa side into Hull. And we sent all our students home with their instruments because it had just been announced that there was going to be a 2-week break because of the COVID pandemic, which was so just emerging, you know, globally in people's imaginations, its implications for the school system and that kind of thing. But what we didn't realize is that, you know, we weren't coming back. On March 13th, as the students kind of ran for the buses, we thought, okay, like it's going to be 2 weeks of navigating this stuff. And what ended up happening over the last year is that the teachers really had to, and to use the word pivot to totally new pedagogies and ways of teaching their subject material that have, I think, implications for the way that we continue to teach our subject material well into the future, whether there is such a thing as a post-pandemic or not. And we don't even know what that looks like. So in some ways, it's really bringing your teaching and your concept of what interacting with children is like and what pedagogies look like into like a new temporal frame, and we and that we're living in this present moment without a really clear path as to what the implications are for our practice in the future, and also those implications for things like teacher education. So it's a really interesting time to be working with children. To go back to your original point about you being in Ottawa and me being in Gatineau, it looked very, very different in the way that it went down. And so that's a really cool point of comparison to say, like, well, what happened and what are the comparables? Should I elaborate on those comparables?
No, well, yeah, for sure. And like, I mean, just before you do, like it was maybe a couple of weeks ahead in March where we were just heading. We usually do a family ski trip to Mount Sutton and we go for 4 days during March break. So we had just crossed the Quebec border and got the phone call from the ski hill saying, look, the Quebec government said we have to shut down. So we're sorry. We'll work things out in the coming weeks in terms of refunds and the place that we had booked was separate. So we had to work on that as well. And so, you know, that was it. That was the end. And like you said, like the kids and us, you know, not knowing and the anxiety around not knowing what the, how the virus acted, what it would be like for everyone, then having to turn and then self-isolate and physically distance from others. I think it went for us from March until really June, July until things open up. So that was the context, at least for our family. But we were kind of relieved in a sense and saddened in many ways, because I know Quebec was hit really hard. And I can't imagine if we had have gone and the government had made that decision in terms of going to the ski hill and being with individuals from the United States or from Quebec during that week, and then just being part of that first flux of infection, not knowing how the virus was going to interact. So those are kind of things that cross your mind thinking back to a year ago. But you talk about like, look, in many ways, the ways in which you forced to kind of shift and rethink the way in which you teach, and you see many of the things that you're doing right now that you're going to take up later, or you're going to continue to do with students moving forward, kind of as a promising practice for pedagogy. But what was it like for you in terms of being a teacher in the school and the kind of context and feelings as a collective community and staff? And how did you navigate that with students? And what was it like? Like, where were students at with you at that point in time as you first entered and then coming back in September?
It was such a difference between the spring, like what happened in the spring and sort of the September piece. And I hear you about the travel. I mean, the Eastern Townships and Montreal got hit really hard at the first time of that pandemic. We were a bit luckier in the Gatineau region. But I mean, the collective imagination around that, we were supposed to travel to Banff actually 2 weeks after with the school band, and that got canceled. And so there's a lot of heartbreak with kids. I think for me, to answer the question of where were we with the students and then like where did we go from there, in Quebec there is no semestering. So what's inherently different about teaching in Quebec versus Ontario is that I'd already been with the students since September, so it wasn't a new term. And so there's a real sense of community when you're teaching the same students every day all year. And what's really great about that is that you have a really close sense of who you're working with, where they're at in terms of their academic achievement, and also what the different personalities are. So when I flipped, there was 2 weeks where teachers were waiting. I think everybody was waiting. And then when we realized we weren't going back to the classroom, our school as a community came together to figure out how could we create a program that would carry us through June and still manage to gather some information from students and also take students who are at risk of not passing and provide the kind of infrastructure that they would need to be able to show competence in their different subjects. So part of it was like a rethinking of what it means to teach and learn, and also a really big piece in like rethinking what it means to assess. And so for me, and I teach grade 9 science, which is a bit of chemistry and a lot of biology, and I teach grade 11. It was a slightly different feel between the different classes, where my grade 9s, who are with me every day and they're quite young, were very keen to start back with their teacher. And what we did was we set up a map where each teacher would have a block on a 1 week, once per week, where they would give a really comprehensive science lesson, and sort of in between time there would be like interesting activities that students could do, or in my case labs that they could do at home or we could do together. And so it became a really interesting transformation. It's like, how could we attend to this curriculum in a totally different format where you don't have the intimacy of seeing your teacher every day? In terms of recovering, like let's say students who are on the line or were really worried, I think there was a lot of fear from students saying like, I was really close to passing, or I really need these credits. Like, what am I going to do? We set up a lot of modules and projects and ways for students to investigate and show their confidence in subjects. And that was a shift in pedagogy. Like, instead of them sort of beating at the daily curriculum, and in some cases beating themselves down over the daily curriculum, there was a lot more openness around like investigating a topic or working with a teacher one-on-one to like demonstrate what they know or they don't know in mathematics or science. And I think in some ways that gave students, a better feeling about their learning. And some students who are traditionally quite quiet in the class really came out of their shell in the online environment. So that gave us a little bit of preliminary data going into the fall. And so here in the fall in Quebec, we have been in the whole time. We have been in school. Everybody's been in school with the exception of a 2-week gap at Christmas since September. And for grades 9 through 11, and I teach 9, 10, and 11, they come in every second day. So for me, that means that some of my classes are virtual and some of them are face-to-face every day, depending on what the student's homeroom code is. And so it gives me a nice balance of being able to see some students and teach them virtually and then just do the flip, you know, on the next day. So for example, today I teach three virtual classes and one face-to-face. So I'll pop over to the school and teach that one group and return home and teach my virtual students in the afternoon.
We've heard teachers being interviewed in the media about the shift and having to do those different formats being a lot of extra work in terms of overall workload. I know that is an ongoing demand and concern for teachers in terms of having to do that work and kind of relearn in many ways to be able to do both at the same time. So if you have students at home and you're teaching them synchronously at home and then also in the classroom, but then also just being in the homes of students. So how has that been for you of having so much more access directly into their homes through the teaching online?
I think there's a number of different things that go on there. So we dealt with some of the fundamental equity issues right up front. There was a mass deployment of laptops and technology. So, you know, now that we had everybody connected quite quickly. Now, in terms of equity, you know, there's always questions around, should students have their camera on? Should we be demanding that students speak live on the audio portion of a Teams call or a Zoom call? What's going on in the background in students' lives and in their homes? I teach in a school that has some socioeconomic challenges. And I know that there's often situations where students are tuning into my class with all the things that you might think, like toddlers in the background or babies. I do have a pet cockatoo that comes to my second period class every day. And so when the student asks a question, you've got this sort of amazing squawking noise in the background, but it's become a bit of a class joke. And it's great because, you know, the cockatoo is biology after all. So you don't know what kinds of conditions under which students are learning. And I'm amazed at the kind of engagement that I have with my students and their ability to articulate their needs. One thing I don't want to ever do is like force students to put a camera on, for example, where that's a kind of privileged space, like a student's bedroom or a student's home is that's their private space. And I don't think like the prying eyes of adults looking into like a kid's bedroom over Zoom is really the way that I want to frame my engagement with students. And so for the most part, I get a high amount of audio engagement with my students and I get almost no video. And so that's fine. And the exception to that is when we do some labs and those labs end up becoming my kitchen island. And often students will put their camera on to show me what they're doing in their own kitchens. And so we've extracted DNA, we've made ice cream using snow and milk and things, and some other really interesting labs. But for the most part, students are most comfortable on audio, and that's elective. What's really nice is that they've built that community. Like, I'm not demanding that they speak. If they don't want to, they can use chat. They can use whatever medium that they want. And the other interesting piece is that I have parents attending my class, if you think about it. I took a little survey. I asked students, like, who's, you know, mom or dad is in the background when I'm teaching? And at least in the ninth grade, at least half of my students have a parent there. And I've actually received emails following a class period, just a random one out of the schedule saying, like, I really enjoyed your lesson today. So I think what's interesting about that is either parents are tuning in. I don't know if they're tuning in to check or they're just tuning in by default because they're also working from home, or if they're genuinely interested in the topic that I'm teaching. So it's a really interesting situation. On the one hand, it does make you feel a little vulnerable. On the other hand, because that space where you're the only adult in the room of the classroom, that sort of sanctity of the classroom is cracked open at the seams all over the place, right? And so you have to rethink how you sound and what you're presenting and how other people other than children might interpret that, and people who might not be experts with working with children. So if an adult or a parent says, why did you use this language, or why did you frame it a particular way, or why didn't you teach all 27 elements of this one topic. They're not necessarily sure about things are essential for a particular age.
Yeah, you have. I've heard that in other conversations where now that parents are in the classroom with you, that there's a lot more correspondence in both positive and in many ways, sometimes in negative ways, where parents are following up, it, like you said, like, why aren't you teaching this? Or why have you said that? Or even intervening in challenging the teacher in terms of, okay, it's Black History Month, and I heard the way in which you made reference to this, and I don't think you should be using that type of language when you're talking about racisms and racialization with these kids and the way in which my child's being positioned in the class. So you hear a gamut of feedback in terms of now parents being in the classroom with their kids listening to what teachers are saying. So if you're an amazing teacher, excellent, you're doing that kind of work and parents are on board, it's great. But then if you have parents that don't necessarily agree with your pedagogical approach or the curriculum, then it becomes a challenge in terms of having to always explain yourself.
Yeah, and we've always had parents, parents come from in all shapes and sizes. And so I think what's different is exactly what you point to. Like in the past for parents who have objected to sexuality education, which is in my curriculum, often it's more speculative, right? Like I don't want my student to attend this particular unit, and they've inspected the textbook or they've looked at the curriculum or they've looked at, in our case, Quebec has a really really open and gender friendly, quality driven focus around those topics. And for some parents, that's not palpable for them. But they don't actually get to see what I say about those topics in the classroom. And so they will choose to pull their student out or apply. In Quebec, you have to apply for a legal exemption for that, based on what they think will happen. And I think this year I've been really lucky. My parents have been amazing. But at the same time, they could actually hear the content itself. And that's definitely a different feeling.
Well, I mean, it really changes the way in which we might think about the school and the classroom as being open to the community, where the teacher is a member of the community, not just with kids and thinking about like, look, when my child leaves, they're in your hands alone. But now parents, perhaps in a more hopeful light, get to see, like, look, Tasha Osman is the teacher of our community, and here's what our community is taking up and addressing within the context, too, of what you said, trying to remember each student is an individual, they're a human being, and how do we develop or foster those relations during a pandemic? And then also, regardless if there was a pandemic or not, their struggles at school or their successes and how you foster those relations. And that's one of the things I've always admired about you is that, one, I think you're an amazing teacher, and I always reach out to you like for tips and advice to help myself or my son and my own math anxieties. And that's some of the research that you do, but then also your capacity to build relations. And so I'm just wondering, I mean, how has that been now that you have students in the classroom, one? And how did you feel, too, like knowing that you were coming back and with the virus in place, about your own safety and security in terms of your own health and the protocols in place? Like now you've been doing it for a while. Has the pandemic in certain ways provoked you to rethink the way in which you facilitate those kind of relations as a community, whether it's in the classroom or online? And then again, I was just wondering how, you know, your sense of, we hear that again in the media about teachers' concerns around their safety and security in relation to the pandemic and being in the presence of students in a classroom.
Yeah, so there's two pieces there. So like I'll start with the safety and security part. In terms of our physical safety, I think in the fall, everybody was a lot more concerned. I don't think that it's actually been, I don't think people have, diminished their concern around the efficacy of the PPE or the seriousness of the virus, but I think it's become part of our daily routine. And those structures were put in place. So like, I know when I get out of my car on school property, anywhere on school property, you have to wear a mask. There are very specific masks, like not cloth ones or fancy ones. And that's kind of business so that you know what you're wearing, where you're wearing it, and that there is a small space in the classroom where if I want to take my mask off in order to teach, where my students can really see me, there's a distance, line, proximity, so that I've really balanced being really safe when I'm in transit, really safe in my classroom. But you're right that there's a kind of distance situation where if I want the students to see the expressions on my face, I have to stay behind the little line or, you know, mask up and then walk around the room. So it's changed my behavior. And I think now that I'm more used to it, this is great. And the students are more used to it as well. They're looking for hand sanitizer everywhere. It's part of their daily. Like, they go out of the room, they come back in, they hand sanitize. We go to the lab, they hand sanitize. So there's a lot of routine, and children are good at routine. So I think they've really picked it up well. And then you were talking about the relationships with students. And what I find this year is I have, in some ways, much better relationships with my students. You know, this goes back a little bit to the fact that you have the class. I have my classes all year. And what was working for me as a full-time face-to-face classroom teacher in the past still works in terms of building a community, in terms of the kinds of structures we have in place, the kinds of formative assessment for learning environment that I cultivate. What's the benefit of some of students being virtual every second day is that I still see them every day, but my quietest students or some students who might be afraid to ask a question now have this technology built in, such as Teams, where there is a chat. You can chat one-on-one with your teacher just by sending them a message. And I've also set up group chats for all of my classes. So like science, section 07, 09, you know, all these groups that I teach, I'll say, okay, today, make sure you have your notebook in front of you. And we're going to, you know, do a diagram together, whatever. And they will respond to each other using that chat for things that far exceed the boundaries of the science class. So I've seen wonderful things from the students between one another where they've used the science chat to talk about another class. Like if the teacher calls on me in French, I swear I'm going to start crying. And if you see actually dialogue where students are saying, you can do it, I believe in you, you're really great. Like, you know, just say this, you know, she's going to be fine. And, you know, so students are boosting each other up around some of the competencies that they used to have a lot of fear about, using chat as the background for some of the face-to-face interactions, some of the virtual interactions that they're having either in my class or in other classes. And it's kind of this amazing thing to witness. So there's a sense of safety and security. I get a lot of texts well into the evening and late at night. And so students are taking on the concept of accountability and the concept of like what it means to have your work done in certain ways to new dimensions. When I got a message this morning from a student who said, I was absent. Here's a photograph of my assignment. I wanted you to know it was done and I'm going to turn it in our next face-to-face class. Well, that was not available in the past. And so what I'm getting is that students are like breaking the boundaries of the conventional, like bell to bell, like that's the block in which you teach. And that's my access to that teacher outside of like lunch remediation, and saying, okay, well, like that teacher is available all of the time. So in some ways it's hard to manage. You have students asking random bizarre questions late at night about science, the world, biology, you know, the future of the universe. But you might also have a situation where students are like, you know, asking about their work and going to the future of the universe type of questions. I'm really pleased that students are thinking outside the box. And it means that they think about math, they think about science. I've had questions about the GameStop stuff. We've had questions about human biology or like their parents' genetics or like God knows what. And so what it means is that the mythology that children only attend to your particular subject within the bounds of that particular class, go home, do a prescribed set of homework and come back the next day is not true. It's kind of like this rich data source of looking at how children think, behave, and interact with adults and other people around them through this digital medium that's married with the fact that I still get to see them 3 times a week.
So, I mean, and you talked about boundaries there. So for example, like being open, like I know for you, your own disposition, you're like open. Okay. Like, look, if you need to get a hold of me as a teacher, get a hold of me. But I not all teachers or even university professors might be open to kind of that availability per se. So you being available to them and then seeing them shift. But I think it's also important that they know that you're available. And so there's that kind of that trust they have in you in terms of saying like, look, I can send this and it'll be well received from my teacher and they know that I'm doing my work or I'm trying to do my best. And then in terms of what you said, the students supporting each other, I see that with my oldest son. Like, you know, he's down here playing video games. I say down here, I'm in the basement at his station playing video games with his friends. But I hear them talking about like, hey, did you study for this math test? Hey, what did you think of this question? How are you working on this assignment? So as they're playing the video games with three or four of them, they are talking through like what they learned that day, what they're thinking about tomorrow, how they're going to present it. And sometimes they're in the same group together where they're doing a group presentation. So they're multitasking in that sense. And then, as you said, and thinking about the universe, I my youngest son was so excited in terms of the new Land Rover that landed on Mars. He's like, Dad, do you know like the images and you know how long it took to get there and what we're able to see? So, you know, so excited in terms of what they're seeing at school, despite being in the current context of pandemic. So I just think that that's exciting. But coming back to that, you're available all the time, and that is part of your disposition. But, you know, what happens, or how are you feeling in terms of like, look, you work in the teacher education program at the University of Ottawa, and you also teach in our grad studies program. What kind of advice would you give to teacher candidates in light of like, look, your availability and what your philosophy is versus what might be the reasonable expectations in terms of their students?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I know I make myself available 24/7. And I also know that I don't have young children at home in terms of managing a family life in that sense outside of the school. So these things aren't easily substituted or translated when I can't tell other people, my colleagues or teacher candidates, what their home life should look like. But on the other hand, I think what is something that we can convey as people who teach in the Bachelor of Ed program, or even grad studies, where a lot of these conversations are coming up around what constitutes good assessment or time, those kinds of things, is to really just establish for the students what your boundaries are. And students are extraordinarily accommodating, fluid, and really kind, actually. So if you say, listen, I can't answer any questions, you know, between 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. the next morning, if you're going to get it to me, you got to get it to me in this time frame, students will do it. They're very respectful. And so I think it's just about setting clear expectations, which is something that, you know, we would probably teach our teacher ed candidates in the first place. Like, clear expectations is part of good pedagogy. It's part of classroom management. It's part of a student's sense of well-being and security in the classroom, whether those clear expectations are about assignments or about interpersonal reactions. Those interpersonal relations, with each other are part of what we're teaching kids to navigate. Like, in this era of teaching, the students are digital natives, of course, and their world transcends probably so many more apps and so many more ways of interacting on Discord, on gaming, just like you were describing, things that like I didn't grow up with. As adults, it's in some ways, it's nice to tell them about the concept of bounded time and space when they live in at a time that is so limitless, and it transcends, you can transcend time and space at the touch of your fingertips. And so part of my pedagogy is being like, what goes where in some time slots? And when people are having supper, you might not want to like demand an answer from your teacher like right then and send them two follow-up messages. Like, why is that? And not everyone's home looks the same and not everyone's dinner hour is the same, but this is a possibility. And so in some ways, it's part of the teaching. It's part of the teaching culture now to like work with kids around those kinds of things and to establish those boundaries for them.
And coming back where you say like there's a genuine kindness amongst the kids and youth that you're working, that you have an openness to that. And then rethinking also your pedagogy, but you've always been open to researching your pedagogy and critically questioning it. And I want to hear a little bit about, you know, your essay that you wrote based on your doctoral work, your doctoral research, Renderings of Loving Kindness, Dialogic Engagements in the Mathematics Classroom. And in that piece, you're really trying to understand students' anxiety around math, but then also your own positionality. And you draw on psychoanalysis to kind of look at the psychic life of the transference and countertransference of the relationship between the student's anxiety with you as the teacher, but then also your own anxiety in relation to their expectations of you in terms of love and hate and self-loathing and all of these different kind of psychic and emotional dimensions of the classroom that we don't necessarily often look at in research or talk about in relation to mathematics education. So, I mean, even if we didn't have the pandemic or the context to think about the kind of anxieties that that might cause, it doesn't go away, say, when the pandemic ends for some students in relation to mathematics education. So I was just wondering a little bit if you could share, you know, what were you thinking, trying to think through that in terms of teaching math, and what have you learned from that in relation to teaching math now, but also other courses in other areas of your profession?
Yeah, absolutely. And that piece was a really key, like sort of a pivotal moment in looking at the intersection between the kinds of representations students can put forth in relation to their learning and the kind of vulnerability that they're willing to express and the kind of vulnerability I'm willing to put on the page, or whether artistically or through language, to examine the sometimes strained or tenuous relationship people have, not just with mathematics, which is often what you see in the research literature, that people have a relationship one way or the other with mathematics, the content, but there's also mathematics, the teacher, and mathematics, you know, the pedagogy. And it's not often neglected overall as a research area in terms of looking at good pedagogical strategies or ways for students to engage more fully with the curriculum or overcome issues. What we might not be attending to is how our own relationships and our own perhaps even trauma or our own histories of learning or not learning in those spaces like mathematics that have a public persona of being difficult, of being essential, of being rational, and that you either can apprehend the content or you can't. So very finite in ways, and that, like, how do people's identities as both teachers and students, like, come up against these discourses? And so by examining my own relationship with both teaching and with the subject itself, what I wanted to do was say, okay, by looking inward and by looking at the artifacts that I produce in relation to the kinds of interactions I'm having with the very real children in front of me, what am I getting in return? And like, what also are students willing to say or feel safe to say or not say in relation to their history of mathematics learning and their present relationship with me and the subject? And what that's asking us to do as teachers, like, it's one thing as a research piece, but it's another thing to say, like, I'm doing this from the position of the classroom and perhaps hoping that other mathematics and science teachers would do the same thing, is to say, like, what's our willingness to be vulnerable and to ask the questions and do some self-subversive self-reflection around our own relationships with other human beings over which we have power and over a content that over which we feel like over which we have power. We're empowered by that content. Like, I know math and everyone in front of me is going to learn that from me. You know, how can we unpack those things? And one of the ways to do that was by completely blowing the mathematics out of the research piece and saying, like, can we do this artistically? Can we do this linguistically? And ask students to, like, crack open the boundaries of the math class and say, if you were to draw your experience, or if you were to write about your experience or tweet it or Instagram it, you know, in future research, what would that look like? And so instead of asking them to do something mathematical about mathematics, like, you know, you can't really peel back something if the medium isn't inherently comfortable to the students.
Yeah, and I just wanted to read this one passage because I think it's important to, it highlights some of the questions that you're thinking through, and not just in this piece, but across your work. You say, then a troubling possibility occurred to me. What if I make my students feel totally crushed in ways I do not even know? Have I left them suspended, held hostage between bells, words not spoken between us that should have been aired? Just as a conversation might have mended the moments between adults, what are the possibilities inherent in opening up dialogue in my classroom? Am I doing enough to change the space from one potentially full of isolation and powerlessness to one where love and kindness prevail? And so there's this prevailing theme of love and kindness, and in many ways you're looking at the loving kindness from the Pali word metta, found in the Vedic literature and is employed as in the practice of Buddhism. So you're looking at Buddhism and principles of Buddhism and contemplation and a meditative state in relation to the rethinking? And then, as you said, like the different mediums to have students think about representing their relationship with mathematics, whether that's journal entries or drawings. But also, you know, you have that other piece that you recently wrote on yoga and the ways in which yoga is being taken up in your school. So I see you on the one hand leaning on Buddhism to rethink the work you're doing, but then also very critical in the sense of how certain cultural practices like yoga is being taken up at your school and how you as a teacher are being forced to afford it opportunities, welcome or unwelcomed, within your classroom in terms of the way it's being taken up. And I was wondering if you could share a little bit about that.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a tenuous link. I think when I'm invoking the concept of loving kindness, it's actually closer to the, and as you say, critical piece about yoga than you might think. And I think because the core of it really is about a kind of a meditative, introspective, vulnerable piece that allows us for a degree of self-critique, and as teachers in the classroom, and let students be truly honest and build that relationship with you on grounds that are always shaky for them, because you're in the position of power by default. Like in teacher education, when we talk about classroom management, I sometimes ask teachers, you know, if you've ever felt the inclination to yell at the class, like you already have power, you don't need to exercise it, like, you know, to the nth degree. You're already the only adult in the room. When we're talking about yoga, it's also about, in some ways, power, and then this juxtaposition with the meditative. And in that particular piece, what I was honing on was who, once again, like who's at the center of that particular practice. So if the person delivering to children something that's meant to be transformative and introspective and spiritual as a pedagogy is doing so using tropes of Eastern mysticism or reenacting colonial history and all of the capitalistic tropes that go with it, you know, such as the appropriation of certain signs and symbols. And then, like, you know, that's of course manufactured into Lululemon products and branded yoga mats, and presenting that to children in a way that is deemed authentic because they don't know any different. Then there's a kind of violence there. There's a kind of inauthenticity that goes that's hand in hand with white supremacy. And so if we're going to decolonize school spaces, or we're going to ask people, or like going back to the math paper, if we're going to ask people to engage with us, to walk with us on a journey towards something meditative, whether that's a yoga practice meant to help kids in the classroom, or whether that's a research project and also a classroom practice that's going to help mathematics students, we have to do it with the intent of equity, with the intent of respect, and with all of our doors open and minds open around, you know, how we're situated in positions of power when we're representing certain kinds of practices. I think in both cases, we're looking at something that we're taking up, you know, spiritually and introspectively, but in the case of the yoga paper, what's so difficult is navigating that terrain with and alongside, you know, a pedagogy that's really rooted in colonialism.
I was wondering if you were willing to share a little bit of the context that paper emerged out of in relation to you trying to rethink your relationship to yoga itself, you as a teacher, you as an individual and researcher, and then the kind of classroom context that the paper was in relation to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or school community context. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, here in the podcast, so folks might not have read it, but the short version is that there was a yoga program that was offered to the school by an outside staff member, so not a classroom teacher. And that person is well-intentioned, white, cisgendered female, you know, yoga teacher who has learned their yoga practice and been certified through local studios. And because of the pandemic, a lot of students can't go to the gym for their exercise. And so, you know, the idea was to have students bring their chairs into the aisle and practice certain yoga stretches and moves. And sort of that on its surface was not a problem at all. And that's not really what's in contention. And the wonderful thing about the roots of yoga is that it's not, there is no proprietary, like it doesn't belong to anybody. And so that's maybe why yoga feels and is so accessible to many people. But what sort of unfolded in the session was the activation of a lot of misrepresentations of Sanskrit language, using the language to like mystify rather than demystify the kinds of poses that students were meant to do, misuse of the language, and sort of a comical portrayal of Hindu and Vedic culture. So things like using namaste and like, you know, those kind of cliched phrases like aligning your chakras or whatever, which mean very little to like 14-year-old, you know, kids in a ninth grade science class. So it's not so much that that mistake was made, but that when the mistake was brought up, the person in charge of it like said, well, you know, that's not what your culture means to me. And so I'm going to interpret it my way. And so there, now you end up in a situation where, okay, well, what are, if, and I work at a place that is completely committed to decolonization in all aspects of the school. And of course, that's a work in progress. So it became a little bit of a roadblock to say, well, how do we align this, you know, this acute problem with our overall philosophy as an institution? Actually, since writing that paper, we've had a session, like we've had a sit down and really laid out the problem, South Asian teachers and myself, myself included, with the yoga instructor to say, like, this is what we're talking about when we're asking for you to like sort of back away from those cliches of Eastern culture and the misuse and misrepresentation of Indian culture overall.
I mean, just to come back to your piece, and if you indulge me again, I just want to read a little passage. It says, you say, as a Desi Canadian familiar with yoga's Indian roots, I've always observed the industry from the outside as a place where the new age consumerist tropes of promised enlightenment through branded yoga mats, Lululemon pants, and expensive memberships were inaccessible to me in numerous ways. Over the course of the next 40 minutes, I watched the children being instructed to put their hands in a namaste position, quote unquote namaste position, and then raise their arms over their heads and stretch their spirits to the sky. My uneasiness soon turned to anger. I'm glad that you were able to meet and have that conversation and work towards trying to redress the way in which, although you're in this piece looking at the concept of unconditional hospitality and what that entails in relation to having and respecting conditions, that both the guest and the host, and the guest is a host, to revisit that relationship.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's, you know, there's a little bit later in the piece and it's a quote from somebody else, but I think one of the big things that we have to tackle as Desi Canadians, but also as any member of a minority group who is, aspects of their culture become very attractive, you know, to capitalism and marketing. And we see that with smudging. You can buy like a smudge kit off Amazon or whatever, and like just do that up in your house or in your classroom. Imagine how inappropriate it would be to bring in people's spiritual and cultural practices into acontextual situations. But later in the paper, that the quote that I'm referring to is that positivity is often the Trojan horse that, you know, smuggles white supremacy into the gates. And so I think that really applies to yoga when we see, like, you know, one of the responses was that you should be happy. You should be happy that we're celebrating your culture. We're celebrating it and we're championing it. We're not stealing it and we're not repackaging it, but like actually that is the case. So there's a fine line between appreciation and actual like cultural theft. And what's extra difficult in this particular scenario is that the scene of it is with children, with young children who don't know the difference.
So don't worry, be happy. It's positive appropriation.
Don't worry, be happy. It's positive, right? Appropriation. Yeah. Don't worry. And you should be grateful, you know, like you should be grateful, well, yes, that I'm talking about your culture. And so that gratitude piece is very much like old school colonialism. Like you should be happy. We've like come in and built a factory and paying all these workers who formerly were unemployed $1 an hour, 10 cents an hour to make sweatshirts, you know, in the Nike factory, because we've raised your economic prospects, but it doesn't make it like that. That kind of like you should be grateful. There's always capitalistic undertones there, and there's always a colonial imperative there. It's never altruistic, and so that's the thing where, and it only works from one direction, right? Like it only can work outwards towards minority folks from the colonial metropole. It's not like minorities can be like, you should be grateful that we're all having, you know, we're all partaking in white culture, if one could use a word, that phrase even.
Well, I mean, like, if we think about the school as a facility, like even its very structure and the way in which it's serviced by public funding, I mean, here in a settler colonial nation like Canada, I mean, it's built into the very geographical political fabric, right? So, I mean, the context of trying to disrupt that, like you said, like it's a starting point, mm-hmm. but there's so much work to be done. Thanks for sharing on those two pieces. I just wanted to kind of end the podcast by talking to you. I know something that you're really passionate about that's been deeply affected for a lot of different people during the pandemic, and that's your musical life. So, you know, not only are you an amazing, math, science, I think any subject someone was to give you, you're just an amazing teacher, and that includes like working within the teacher ed program and grad studies, but you also play with the Ottawa Chamber Orchestra and you play your bassoon. I've yet to make it out, which is, it's so bad of me because I've known you for so long. So I, you know, once things open up, I want to be there at the first concert to see you play. And I think my kids too, they need
I'll
to
hold you to it.
Yeah.
I'll
they need to it. Develop more of a musical appreciation for the complexity of what it takes to make that happen. And I can appreciate it in some sense because I played big band and jazz for 4 years when I was in high school. And it was really, for me, it was very much an escape from other things at the school. And we had a brilliant music teacher, could teach anyone to play anything that they were passionate about playing, even though, you know, and I have such appreciation for music teachers who can teach you how to play instruments that they don't necessarily play themselves. And so, you know, how has that been for you?
Well, for me as a musician, it's been devastating. I mean, it's there's a couple of layers to that. One, it's the personal, right? Like the impetus to practice, to take it out. Like I'm looking at it right now in my living room. I'm looking at my bassoon sitting there. I look at all these reeds that I have made and I'm looking at all this repertoire that's sitting there. It's sitting there unfinished. It's sitting there unplayed. And so there's a real sense of loss. And there's also a real sadness that, like, when you're practicing, you're part of our performing art is to play with people and to play for people. So it's been pretty tough to motivate myself to practice. But on the other hand, what's a real joy is that I live in a semi-detached home, which means my neighbor is through the wall and he's principal trumpet of the Ottawa Symphony. And so every single day for 3 to 4 hours, and sometimes when I'm virtually teaching, which is kind of a nice thing, the kids can't hear it because I have headphones on, but I can hear him playing. I can hear him playing every single day. And he teaches also on Zoom for a number of schools around the city and privately. So it's this interesting juxtaposition of seeing someone who just keeps on doing it and then kind of witnessing my own desiccation as a musician here at home. And so I've taken it out and I've played and I've practiced. Now, in good news, we had the first rehearsal for the Ottawa Chamber Orchestra this past Sunday. It was a strings only rehearsal, our venue at Notre Dame Cathedral, which is a gorgeous cathedral downtown, I'm sure you know, with the beautiful spires near the art gallery. And so to be able to, now that Ottawa's gone to the orange zone, to be able to bring strings back to be and play chamber music, to play Corelli, to play Grieg, to play some other pieces, and also to provide a Zoom link for those folks who are still on curfew in Quebec but might want to play at home, those string folks, and they'll be able to join us now that the curfew, I think, has been extended to 9:30 at night, which gives us some time for rehearsal, it's to really, really a huge piece of morale boost to be able to see my colleagues back in action. So even as a wind player, even though that's not permitted at the moment, just witnessing all of my colleagues in a room was, I think, definitely was emotional for me, you know, this weekend. And it's the start to bringing us back to life. The other piece is that the arts community suffered a great deal this year. And overall, you see a lot of musicians, a lot of opera singers, a lot of folks that I know very well who have struggled with their craft, with freelancing, with gigs and all that stuff. Of course, it dried up. So my goal is to, you know, ensure that the OCO, I'm on the executive there, and just ensure that the OCO is back up and running in September, if at all possible, but also just to reconnect with the people that I loved and I love sitting with and making music with. And there's a real joy there. And I think people are looking for that. I think people are looking for to restore some of the void that opened up emotionally for a lot of people. And people feel it in different ways through sports, through other forms of interaction, dance, music, whatever community things they're involved in. And I think for those of us who are both freelance and also community musicians, getting back to work or just getting back to playing is a huge part of our psychology. And the other piece is, of course, our school band. I have and had such a beautiful school band full of enthusiastic kids, and we were days away from getting on a plane to Banff. So I want to launch that program in September as well, provided the government lets us do it.
Well, and you have the Film and Write has the YouTube channel too. Is that still going, or are you able to, I guess you're able to meet, but I don't know if you're permitted to gather with the band inside the school and practice.
No, we're not. We're not allowed to have any wind instrument playing. So the music teachers who have that course load this year are doing a lot of really innovative stuff. We bought class sets of ukuleles. Not something everyone knew everything about, but musicians are pretty versatile and they learned it. And also the kids are having a good time, but also a lot of other creative pedagogies for music classes, looking at how to do a music technology and how to do composition that way and look at music appreciation. But we're hoping to be back in the fall in person.
Well, how lucky for you too, you play the bassoon, but then fortuitous for your neighbor who plays the trumpet to live beside you. So you're appreciative, but then you also beside him, because that might not always be the case in terms of neighbors.
Yeah, no, it's great. I can't imagine. I mean, if you didn't, you know, if you weren't part of this world, I'm not sure how, you know, a different neighbor would appreciate like Mahler excerpts and pictures at an exhibition at, you know, 8 o'clock at night. But I think it's fantastic. And it reminds me of my own conservatory days, right? Where you hear someone in the practice room next door. It's like really heartwarming. It brings me back memory wise. It feels like home. It feels familiar. People's warm-ups and scales and that, like that's my life as well. But it just, every time I hear it, I like, it returns me to a really, like, it's like a security blanket. So it's amazing.
Well, thanks a lot, Tasha. We didn't really get a chance to delve deeply into some of the other topics that I wanted to talk to you about. So hope you can come back again in the future. We can touch base, you know, and talk about when everyone gets the vaccination, or those that get the vaccination, things roll out and open up again. I'd love to have you back on the show to talk about that and other stuff, and just wishing you the best over the next few weeks. I think March break is coming up for you all. And I think also when you get a chance, I'm going to reach out to Stephen Hurley in the morning. I think he would love to talk to you at least once a week about what you're doing with students in the classroom. So just thanks again for your generosity and your time and for the amazing work you're doing at Film and Write with students. And also we're so lucky to have you at the University of Ottawa working with teacher candidates and grad students. So thank you very much for coming on the podcast today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure. And I would be pleased to come back and update you and talk about my current research as well.